The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and from the Harvard Heart Letter. And the first article is going to be the July 2021 issue of the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled, Baby, It's Cold Inside. Why are you cold even when it's hot out? Older age and underlying conditions can affect your thermostat. It's warm outside, yet you're grabbing a sweater because you frequently feel cold. Is it in your head? Are you really experiencing a personal permafrost? Don't worry. Lots of older people feel cold, and it could reflect any of a number of potential causes. A sophisticated thermostat. We all need to maintain a certain core temperature, about 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, to keep the body's many systems and biologic processes in good working order. The body has a way to protect this temperature. If the core temperature rises, like during activity when the working muscles produce heat, the body gives off steam. We sweat and our blood vessels widen, allowing body heat to radiate away from our skin. If the core temperature falls, the body conserves heat in its core. A network of very small blood vessels narrows, and less blood is delivered to the skin surface where heat escapes, says Dr. David M. Nathan, director of the Diabetes Center and Clinical Research Center at Massachusetts General Hospital, and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. We don't really know why some older adults feel cold all the time, Dr. Nathan says. It's unlikely that our core temperature changes as we age, but there could be other age-related explanations for why we feel cold. One theory is related to inactivity. You're moving less, even walking slowly, and your muscles aren't producing as much heat as they used to, so you feel cold, Dr. Suzanne Salomon says. She's the Associate Chief of Gerontology of Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Another theory is tied to age-related changes in appetite and weight. If with aging you have a smaller appetite and don't eat as much, you might lose fat or insulation, Dr. Nathan says. Sometimes you can feel cold because of an underlying condition, such as one of the following. The first is anemia. If you have anemia, you have fewer red blood cells to carry oxygen throughout the body, and that sometimes makes you feel cold, Dr. Salomon says. An underactive thyroid. The thyroid gland in the neck releases thyroid hormone, the master regulator of our metabolism, the biochemical process in our body. When thyroid hormone levels are low, the thermostat gets turned down and makes a person feel cold, Dr. Nathan says. Peripheral artery disease. Narrowed arteries in the limbs results in reduced blood flow, which may cause the arms or legs to feel cold. Raynaud's phenomenon. In this condition, the reaction to cold gets exaggerated. Blood vessels in the extremities, especially the fingertips, constrict, causing the fingertips to feel cold and turn blue or white because blood flow is reduced, Dr. Nathan says. Crossed wires. Another possible reason for feeling cold all the time is that your nervous system has changed a little, making the brain perceive that you're cold. Some conditions impair the autonomic nervous system, which controls your temperature reflexes. You can have abnormal periods of sweating and then cool arms and legs because somewhere in your nervous system, the autonomic nerves are giving the wrong signals to your brain. An example is diabetic neuropathy, in which diabetes damages nerves, causing tingling in the legs and feet. It can also make you feel cold. If nerves that control the small blood vessels don't function normally, you may not be able to regulate the skin temperature in your feet and legs, Dr. Nathan says. Other conditions that can cause mixed temperature signals include chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's disease. But Dr. Nathan stresses that just because you feel cold, it doesn't mean you have any of these conditions. If you experience coldness that interferes with your daily activities or sleep, talk to your doctor about it at your next appointment. I might check for an underactive thyroid or anemia just to make sure nothing is wrong, Dr. Salomon says. But it's rare for an older adult to say that they're hot all the time. It's much more common to hear that they're cold. What should you do? Treat underlying conditions and try to be more active. Walk as much as you can if it's safe for you, and exercise regularly if you don't already, Dr. Salomon says. In the meantime, keep that sweater handy. Next is a interesting article from the Harvard Health Letter of July 2021, entitled, "Are Home Pain Relief Gadgets Safe for Use?" Some make big promises but may pose big health risks. Here's what to watch for. Desperate times call for desperate measures. That's how many people feel when they have chronic pain. They'll try anything to get rid of it. For some, the desperate measure is buying a gadget promised to ease aches and pains with the push of a button. If that's your strategy, beware. The move may come with more risks than relief. You can find a wide range of pain relief gadgets to use at home. There are devices claiming to interrupt pain signals to the brain with bioantennas embedded in skin patches, squeeze pain away with compression cuffs, or eliminate pain with ultrasound technology. Electric stimulation, heat, lasers, vibration, pressure, light, radio frequency, infrared rays, or pulsed electromagnetic fields. These devices often have credible-looking, convincing ads that tout clinical evidence and testimonials from doctors. While there could be something to those claims, don't believe them without doing some digging. The problem is that there are doctors who will accept money to conduct a small study and then say a treatment helps, but that's not evidence. The kind of validation that's important is a large study in a well-respected, peer-reviewed medical journal, says Dr. David Binder, a physiatrist and director of innovation at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Like any industry, the pain relief industry has some bad actors who prey on vulnerable populations, and that means trouble. Some possible outcomes. The product doesn't work. No matter how many great testimonials the product receives, it might not work because it's not right for you or your condition, or simply because it's junk. You lose a lot of money. Some pain relief gadgets cost hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Using the product could be dangerous. People with particular conditions should avoid some types of devices. For example, you wouldn't want to put anything with an electrical stimulation near a pacemaker, and your doctor needs to weigh in before you use devices that squeeze your legs if you have impaired circulation, swelling of the legs, or a history of blood clots. If a product uses heat, you could burn yourself if you have nerve damage and can't feel your skin getting hotter. Perhaps most importantly, using the product keeps you from seeking medical care. If you buy a pain relief device and skip seeing a doctor about your condition, it might delay an important diagnosis and a needed treatment, Dr. Binder points out. Be suspicious if you see advanced medical technologies in a home pain relief device. For example, Dr. Binder recommends staying away from gadgets that use the following technology. The first is light therapy. Light therapy has many important uses in medicine, but it's not well established for pain relief. The evidence is weak, Dr. Binder says. Radio frequency. For pain relief, doctors sometimes use the heat waves of radio frequency in procedures to dull specific nerves in the spine. But radio frequency is not a do-it-yourself home treatment, Dr. Binder warns. Before buying, you should talk to your doctor. Print the ad for the pain relief gadget and bring it to an appointment, Dr. Binder says. The doctor can assess whether it makes sense, if there is a prescription version of the device that would be safer, or if there is an alternative treatment that would be better. Another good idea is to try certain technologies at a physical therapy clinic before buying a home version. One example is transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, or TENS, T-E-N-S, which uses tiny electrical shocks on the skin to interrupt pain signals. It doesn't work for everyone. Also, make sure a high-tech device is FDA approved, which means it's safe and effective, not just listed or registered with the FDA, which is required of all home health devices. You can look up devices to see if they are FDA approved by going to www.health.harvard.edu/device, D-E-V-I-C-E. So what fills the bill? A home TENS machine is the only high-tech pain relief device Dr. Binder feels comfortable recommending. Ask your doctor or physical therapist which voltage is safe for your particular condition. And don't exclude these low-tech devices, which may also relieve pain. A foam roller to stretch out muscles or tight bands of tissue. Massagers like massage cushions, vests, or handheld devices. And heat or cold packs or skin patches. You'll find those at any big box store. They're generally safe for use, and they're not going to break the bank. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter of July 2021. And the first article is called Advice About Daily Aspirin. Should you take this anti-clotting drug to prevent a heart attack or stroke? In the late 1980s, many middle-aged adults began taking aspirin on a regular basis, following findings from a famous Harvard study. Aspirin helps prevent blood clots that can restrict blood flow and trigger a heart attack or stroke. But there is a price to pay for that cardiovascular protection, a heightened risk of bleeding. The benefit of taking a daily low-dose aspirin always has to be counterbalanced with the risk of bleeding, which is usually minor but sometimes serious, says Dr. Christopher Cannon, a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Over the past three decades, we've learned a lot more about aspirin's benefits and risks in a broad range of people, including those with certain health conditions and older adults. Today, about half of Americans age 45 and older take a daily low-dose aspirin. For some of these people, it's a good idea. Others should consider stopping, as the risks slightly outweigh the benefits. But many people fall somewhere in the middle. Here is the latest about who should consider aspirin to prevent heart attacks and who should avoid it. Remember, even if you're in the yes category, meaning that you should take aspirin, and especially if you fall under the maybe classification, never take or stop taking aspirin without first discussing it with your doctor. Yes, people who've already had a heart attack or stroke caused by a blood clot. For these people, a daily aspirin often makes sense. This practice, known as secondary prevention, applies to anyone with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. That includes all conditions caused by plaque buildup anywhere in the body, not just heart attacks and ischemic strokes, but also transient ischemic attacks, angina, or chest pain from narrowed heart arteries, and peripheral artery disease from plaque and leg arteries. Anyone who's had coronary bypass surgery or a stent implanted to restore blood flow to the heart also is considered to have ASCVD and may be a candidate for taking aspirin. Next is maybe. People with evidence of ASCVD on an imaging test. This group of people includes those who are at high risk of heart-related problems based on visual evidence of plaque in their arteries. The tests include a coronary artery calcium scan, a CT scan done for another reason, like screening for lung cancer or pulmonary embolism, or an ultrasound of the neck arteries. There aren't any large studies showing that aspirin helps these people, Dr. Cannon cautions. The benefit probably outweighs the risk, but the calculation will depend on your individual situation, he adds. Maybe. People with diabetes. In general, people ages 40 to 70 with diabetes who face a high risk of heart disease should consider low-dose aspirin. You can estimate your 10-year risk of ASCVD with a calculator created by the American Heart Association and American College of Cardiology. It can be found at www.health.harvard.edu/heart-risk. High risk is defined as a 10-year risk of 20% or greater. Maybe. People at risk for both clotting and bleeding. For the most part, people without ASCVD at risk of bleeding should not take daily aspirin. That includes anyone with a history of bleeding in the gastrointestinal tract or elsewhere in the body. A stomach ulcer, low blood platelets, blood clotting disorders, and people who take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, such as people with arthritis or other painful inflammatory conditions. The one exception is people with a 10-year ASCVD risk score of 20% or higher, in which the cardiovascular risk may outweigh the bleeding risk. Taking a proton pump inhibitor like omeprazole, along with aspirin, can help diminish the chance of gastrointestinal bleeding, says Dr. Cannon. Probably not anyone over 70 without ASCVD. Because bleeding risk rises with age, most people without ASCVD over 70 should not take a daily aspirin. The most recent study in people older than 70 found no significant benefit, but an increased risk of bleeding. If you started taking aspirin in middle age, that may have been a good idea at the time, But once you reach 70, the bleeding risk of daily aspirin may outweigh any protection against heart attack or stroke. So you should check with your doctor about whether you should continue. The article contains what's called an aspirin algorithm, which is a table that gives a quick summary of the current advice about aspirin. Basically, it says that you should take aspirin if you have a condition with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, like a myocardial infarction or a stroke. You might take aspirin if you have an imaging procedure that shows evidence of vascular disease, and you might take aspirin if you are diagnosed with diabetes. You should not take aspirin if you're over the age of 70 and don't have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or diabetes. Associated with this article is an article entitled Fruit of the Month, Stone Fruits. Peaches, nectarines, apricots, plums, and cherries are all considered stone fruits because they contain large, hard seeds or pits. They're all decent sources of fiber, vitamin A, vitamin C, and potassium. They can be eaten right out of hand, but you might also want to try some recipes that they outline in this short article. The first is peach salsa. Dice 2 ripe but still slightly firm peaches and 2 medium tomatoes. Mix with a little minced red onion, jalapeno pepper, cilantro, garlic, and lime juice to taste. Serve with grilled fish or chicken, or on tacos, or other Mexican food. Grilled nectarines. Cut nectarines in half and remove the pits. Brush both sides with a neutral oil like canola oil, and sprinkle with a little brown sugar. Grill them until they're lightly browned, turning once or twice for 3 to 5 minutes. Enjoy them as a side dish or a dessert, or in a salad with arugula, toasted pine nuts, and crumbled feta cheese. Roasted plums. Place halved pitted plums on a baking sheet and toss with a little canola oil. Drizzle with honey and a sprinkle of cinnamon. Roast at 375 degrees for about 30 minutes or until they're soft. Serve them topped with Greek yogurt. Now we're going to turn to Ask the Doctor with Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, who is the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. And again, this is from the July 2021 issue. Living with an implantable defibrillator. My 79-year-old father recently received an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. While he seems to be doing okay, he and my mother are both very anxious about what will happen if he ends up needing a shock. I live nearby and want to support them, so can you offer any advice? I'd also like to be aware of the general advice for people who have these devices. You can reassure your parents that feeling anxious about a shock from an implantable cardioverter defibrillator is understandable and fairly common. An ICD continuously monitors the heart rhythm and rate, checking for abnormalities. If it senses a minor glitch, the device emits a low-energy electric correction that might go unnoticed, but correcting a potentially life-threatening rhythm problem requires a significant jolt. Some patients have told me it feels as though you've been kicked in the chest by a horse. It may help to know that many people with ICDs never receive a shock. In fact, recent improvements allow doctors to program the device to have a longer period of watching to allow the errant rhythm to terminate on its own before delivering a shock. I'd suggest that your father ask his primary care doctor for a referral to a therapist, as there are specific treatments like relaxation therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and support groups that may help ease his anxiety. If a shock does occur, he should call his physician right away, or 911 if he cannot reach the office, experiences more than one shock, or has other symptoms like chest pain. People may lose consciousness after a shock, but that's uncommon. After a shock, most experts recommend the person avoid driving for 6 months, although if there was no loss of consciousness, this restriction may be reduced to 3 months or possibly less. People with ICDs need to be monitored for the rest of their lives, usually about every 3 to 6 months. But newer wireless technology now allows some of these evaluations to be done from home. A special wand that communicates wirelessly with the device sends information from the ICD to a computer. Your father should always wear a medical alert bracelet or carry a wallet identification card to let others know about his ICD in the event of an accident. Finally, the American Heart Association has information about other devices that may, and those that will probably not, interfere with ICDs and pacemakers. This information can be found at www.health.harvard.edu/pacemaker. PACEMAKER. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it. Thank you.